We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Dr. James Miskalic left for Abyei, a war-torn Sudanese village, in 2007 as part of a Doctors Without Borders team. He says as he kept in touch with friends and family back in Canada, he realized, in his words, that people are hungry to be brought closer to the world, even its hard parts. And he says that which separates action from inaction is not indifference, it is distance. He hopes that by telling the stories of Sudan, that distance will again, in his words, fall away. James Miskalic is the author of 6 Months in Sudan, a young doctor in a war-torn village. The book grew out of the blog he created to tell his family and friends about the village where he was focused, its people, its poverty, and the war that ravaged it. The region straddles the border between North and South Sudan. As Dr. Miskalic notes, it had been claimed by 2 armies, but owned by neither. A founding editor of the medical journal Open Medicine, James Miskalic is currently an assistant professor in the University of Toronto's Faculty of Medicine. 6 Months in Sudan, a Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village is published by Spiegel & Grau. You'll find more about our guest, his blog, and his book online at www.6monthsinsudan.com. Dr. Miskalic, welcome. Thanks so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Sure. After decades of war in Sudan, the peace agreement of 2005 held some hope for peace. But this village, Abyei, and a couple of other areas were left out. And then last year, conflict erupted again. And then, as I understand it, the North and South agreed to refer to the matter to a tribunal in The Hague. Can you give us an update?
Sure. You know, the Hague Court of Arbitration was asked to make a decision whether the borders that were established in the 2005 peace agreement were fair. Now, Abyei is defined in the agreement as these 9 tribal chiefdoms, and whether the claim from the north is that the people who decided on the boundaries in 2005 had overstepped their mandate. So last, I guess it was 2 weeks ago or so, July 25th, the Hague delivered their final decision. And many of us whose interest is focused on that place in particular, because it holds so much of the tension between North and South, that long, long war that, you know, predated Darfur by many, many years, we were waiting with bated breath to see what would happen. And as it was, the Hague decided that there was perhaps some mistakes made in the original decision. They suggested a different boundary, which actually was somewhat in favor of the north in that it gave them some more access to oil fields, but it was received peacefully so far. So, you know, as opposed to what happened last year, I was able to breathe a sigh of relief and feel a lot easier going about my day, knowing that that is holding so far.
Yeah. If this is to hold, if it is to succeed, what will be required from both sides?
I think, you know, anytime you have two opposing parties that disagree, whether it's individuals or whether it's groups of people, you have to retreat to a point of consensus, an agreed-upon point of consensus that is, for instance, you know, can't we all agree that we want an end to the war in our country, that we want to get on to a place where our children are able to grow up in peace and somewhat in stability? So I think that if both sides agree with that and decide how to move forward, I think that that is obviously the only way this is going to last in terms of capacity building for the South, which has very little infrastructure, which is, as you might know, you know, war wastes a country away, like chronic disease wastes away a person. And so there's very little infrastructure, very little access to health care. Few people probably understand the necessity or even perhaps how to vote. And I think in anticipation of a referendum in 2011 that is going to decide if the South becomes an autonomous country, an autonomous region, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to encourage the capacity of them to assume that great responsibility.
What happened in the village last year in May of 2008, and what's going on there today?
Well, in 2008, in May 2008, fighting started. I think it was between militia groups on either side. It's often they have loosely affiliated groups, which sometimes it's more politically convenient to do fighting that way than rather, you know, risk the ire of an international community by declaring, you know, a war or, you know, involving obviously many more people in it. So I think it started in between militia groups. You know, their sides declared their allegiances, and eventually the town was razed to the ground, the civilians fleeing to a town about 30 or 40 kilometers away. And today, I understand, since then, it's been relatively peaceful. In anticipation of this decision by The Hague, I've heard the people who had been returned were facing some food shortages because no one really wanted to deliver foodstuffs, knowing that it could end poorly again, waiting for that other shoe to drop. But MSF is starting to work. I actually received a letter or an email from the doctor who's about to assume responsibilities in the hospital there again. So I think people are starting to come back.
Hmm. What led you to apply for your first mission, which was Santiago, Chile?
Well, that was as part of a medical student. That was very early on in my career, as before I even understood there was such thing as, you know, Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders or missions. And I went to Santiago between my first and second year of medical school, not having traveled anywhere, not even knowing that you could go on a plane to a different part of the world and inhabit a different culture. No one in my family had been past high school, and my parents gave me the best advice they could, which was go to university if you can. And I did. I went to and ended up going to medical school and had that first traveling experience. I'm sure many people can share how profound that is at an important time in my medical career as I was forming what I wanted to do. And I realized not only, you know, that great perspective that my story was one of 6 billion stories for the first time, and how small it made you feel and how wonderful the world, how much bigger it was than I realized, but also that if I was being trained to take care of the sick ones, if that's what society expected me to do, if that's why I had a certain privilege by being a physician in society, then it seemed that the sickest people were elsewhere, or so to my eye. And since that moment, I decided to work my career towards, you know, a reality what was very much like I experienced in MBA. I chose emergency medicine because I thought of all the specialties. It gave me the best combination of skills to be used when there's no other resources or no one else around, and also didn't, you know, necessitate me leading patients in a lurch because I don't have a patient practice. I just work shifts. So it was all kind of leading up to this kind of MSF experience.
Mm. And are you still part of the organization?
Yes. Yeah. I, you know, as much as I can be, you know, MSF is known for its vigorous debate and dialogue, internal questions and arguments about it. And it's great to be a part of it as the organization is, you know, changes in response to changing needs in the world. And I look forward to going again in January, I hope, to do another mission. I'm working with a project in Ethiopia that's not to do with MSF, but I anticipate doing another mission early in 2010.
How do you pull in your experiences, these experiences that you have had, and share them with your students now? You're an assistant professor at the University of Toronto in the Faculty of Medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you know, a wonderfully robust area, as opposed to if you're specialized in the, you know, the cornea, maybe there wouldn't be as much to talk about. But when you claim to do international work, and that ends up being the whole world, there's a lot of things to talk about. Yesterday, I had a chance to talk to students in a small group, and there was two students from Jordan, two from Palestine, two from Israel, and two from Toronto. And it's such a wonderful group. Mm-hmm. And I talked to them just about the role of the humanitarian and as a physician. And I find the two have a great congruence, meaning that, you know, one of the principles of humanitarianism, as I interpret, is neutrality, in that to the greatest need goes my attention and my resources. And as a physician, it's the same. You know, I do the best that I can for the person in front of me, regardless of who they are or where they're from. And I think because of that identity, identifying the human in need or the human in suffering, is a natural fit between humanitarianism and being a physician. So it's, I find the students, many, particularly younger ones, are very responsive to that idea.
Mm. What was Abiyé like? What were your first impressions of the village when you arrived?
You know, I remember the plane ride leaving from El Obeid, which is the largest town south of Khartoum, and then it's a small plane ride in a very shaky World Food Program plane to a cracked, rumbling landing strip. And, you know, the town appears for a second, and then it's gone. And then my first thought, of course, is like, that's it? That's there? For 6 months, I'm here? These half-built huts, you know, with straw roofs and clay walls and no power lines and no irrigation system, no ditches. And, you know, my first thought in addition to that is, you know, how there was no one was growing any food. It seemed like, from what I could tell, there was several, you know, hundred, maybe thousands of people in this area in obviously very close, living very close to the earth with not a lot of room for a buffer zone for either of us. And with that initial arrival, it became a very small world for me, from the hospital to my hut back and forth for a long time. And mm-hmm. So my one lingering regret is that I never got a chance to really see very often what was surrounding Abiyé.
Yeah, that beat you were on from the hospital to the place where you slept, marked by just a couple of landmarks.
Yeah, the buried tire in the corner, and then the military compound that was attached to the hospital, you know, from one of the armies. So, you know, when we first arrived to Abiyé, there was a section of the wall, like the military compound was abutting the hospital. A section of the wall had been broken down, and the soldiers were moving freely throughout the hospital. And MSF arrived and said, you know, we will assume responsibilities for the hospital and give free health care and free medicines, but on the one condition that we're going to put that barricade up where that hole in the wall is, and you're welcome to come in, but there's the only rule is there's no guns inside the hospital, and essentially return that place to the people at Abiyé, maybe the only place where people could go and feel that kind of freedom.
Mm. Dr. James Maskelik is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He served with Doctors Without Borders in Sudan, leaving for a war-torn village there, Abiyé, in 2007. He is the author of 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. The book grew out of a blog he created to tell his family and friends about Sudan. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. As a way of further describing the village, maybe you would read an excerpt from the book. And
sure.
This is a blog entry, and it's called 24.
April 10th. A I'm trying to paint a picture of Abye, but all I have are hurried strokes. Yesterday, after dinner, I was sitting in the open space of my compound, Compound 3. It is adjacent to Compound 1. The measles emergency tent used to be here, and eventually a warehouse will be built. Right now it's empty, except for my bed under the tree. The night was ink. Overhead, a flock of white birds flew, fluttering like pieces of paper. They landed above me and noisily settled in for the night. The shuffling wings mixed with the voices of my neighbors and the tinny music of their radios. The air smelled of dust and burning plastic. I woke at dawn, and the birds were gone. The sky was cloudless as I folded my mosquito net and shook the dust from my sheets. The smell of plastic was still in the air. On my way to the hospital, 480 paces, I passed children on donkeys and men on bicycles. I answered them, "Fine, how are you?" "I'm fine." Plastic bags blew by with gusts of wind and were carried into a nearby open field where they flapped thousands strong. I passed two sisters. The youngest, 10, was dressed in a white dress, frills on the shoulders. It was torn, and its white was choked with dust. No princess ever looked more important. I returned from the hospital for lunch and lay down. I was somehow sick again in the middle of a feverish dream, organizing something again. What? Again. When I was called on the handset. A woman had been run over by a car. I opened the door to the emergency room and saw the piece of white bone pushed from her leg, glistening brightly. Later, a large truck pulled into our road and backed up to our gates. They carried from the box a stretcher with a woman and a new baby on it. Twins, we were told. One delivered, the other not. We took her to the delivery room and removed the blanket. Between her legs, a tiny blue arm. I touched it, and the skin came loose. How many days ago was the delivery?
Six.
6 days ago, a baby was born, and her brother, almost. He made it to his shoulder, and finding nothing to hold on to, went no farther. I saw a child in our feeding center whose mother carried with her two pieces of wood. What for? I asked. Well, my translator explained, when she was born there were three. Now she's the only one. So our mother cut two pieces of wood and said, These are your brothers. How long will she keep them? I asked.
Forever, he said.
It is later that same day, near dusk. I am sitting in the compound in the gazebo, typing on the medical computer. Just to my left, Paolo is giving John a haircut. He leaves soon. Antonia just handed me a mirror to inspect my own sorry state. I need a shave. The radio just crackled beside me. I'm on call. Once I'm done with whatever work, night business, the hospital has in mind, I will walk to the kitchen, eat what I can, leave for my compound, shake my sheets, tuck in my mosquito net, and fall asleep. 24.
That is a blog entry that James Maskalik wrote in Sudan. It is now in his book, 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. Measles, accidents, childbirth, what other kinds of needs were there in this village, are there in Sudan?
I think that, you know, you have a population of people who are living so close to absolute poverty. You know, I think it's not unique to Sudan, particularly so there, but with so little access to choose their own, you know, means of freedom, you know, without enough food, without freedom from disease and malaria, how can you really be free? So, you know, not able because of that position to really understand how to perhaps live their life or make a better one for their children. So not just, you know, disease, but, you know, access to food and clean water, an opportunity to choose their own government, perhaps something that we all take for granted. You know, it's something that I hope with writing this book, I think, I kind of want everyone to read it, obviously, not because for any particular reason, just I feel that we have one chance to understand our world. You know, I see that lesson repeated to me every day. And it doesn't diminish your experience of the present moment to know the world that you live in. It doesn't diminish your experience to know where your food comes from or where your effluent flows into the lake. It doesn't diminish your experience of the world. It is experiencing the world to know your place and allow you to choose correctly what you do. I don't think it is necessarily a call to action as it is a call to understanding. And I think that if, you know, I knew when I came back, the thing that you live with inside of you is if you could take 10 people off the street from my street in Toronto and take them to Abbaye and show them a feeding center full of kids who don't have enough food, 8 of them would say, you know, we can never let this happen again. What can we do? And so that's, I think, part of that dissonance that I write about when I start the book.
Yeah. Well, you start the book with some words from Joan Didion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be great if you would read them here at this point.
Sure, they're very important to me when I read them.
Yeah.
I'm not telling you to make the world better, because I don't think that progress is necessarily part of the package. I'm just telling you to live in it, not just to endure it, not just to suffer it, not just to pass through it, but to live in it, to look at it, to try to get the picture, to live recklessly, to take chances, to make your own work and take pride in it, to seize the moment. And if you ask me why you should bother to do that, I could tell you that the grave's a fine and private place, but none I think there do embrace. Nor do they sing there, or write, or argue, or see the title boar on the Amazon, or touch their children, and that's what there is to do, and get it while you can, and good luck at it.
Hmm. That's a wonderful passage.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And that was from a commencement address at the University of California in 1975.
Yeah, I know.
So how did you come across this, and how did it affect you the first time you read it?
A friend of mine, I have a fondness for quotes, and a friend of mine sent it to me several years ago, and I was, you know, prepared, told MSF I was going to go away, made my whole life, you know, packed up everything, gave up my apartment, was sleeping on people's couches waiting for the call to go away, and I was sitting outside in the office of a friend of mine, and my phone rang, and it said MSF Toronto, and I picked it up, and it was a human resources officer said, we have a mission in Darfur, it's only men, because of reasons for security, it's a mobile mission, we're moving all the time, and assessing the needs in, you know, a fairly difficult area, and you know, I said, can I call you back? You know, can I think about it? As my position became a little bit more real, what I was agreeing to do, you know, what now was I willing to lose? And so I left that building without meeting my friend and rode around on my bike in the fall. And I went home and I pulled up that quote and I read it. And then I called MSF back and said, yeah, okay, I'll go. Hmm. And so it was instrumental, I think, in that.
Yeah. Now, that particular mission didn't come off to Darfur, but soon enough, you were in Sudan.
Soon, suddenly, Sudan.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my initial choice for the title of my book, but it was too close to Suddenly Susan. They didn't want to use it. And a young doctor, I think a youngish doctor, you know, I think it's getting less young all the time.
Yeah. So anyway, as you've alluded to now, this would be your first posting in a place ravaged by war. What were your thoughts about that as you were getting ready to leave the place where you're being briefed in Geneva, in Europe, and head on into Sudan?
Well, I think that I developed an interest in, you know, I worked in Cambodia with this rural population of Khmer Rouge who just defected, and I had this really unique contact with some of the people there, a commander in particular, who we talked very frankly about what his life was like since the 70s and what he'd done and where he was now. And I became interested in that concept, in what conflict was, because I couldn't understand it. You know, I didn't understand where that lied inside of me, although it must be there, you know. Of all the things I value in the world and as all the things I lament, I think I can find within myself. But, you know, war, I didn't really know it well enough. And so I had an interest in it. And maybe it was a little self-destructive, but I was, you know, I was curious. And so when I, you know, when I arrived to Abbaye and when I decided to go, of course I was a bit trepidatious. I created a life for myself where I would, you know, I had no family and no responsibilities. So, and such was a perfect candidate to go to a place that was a little bit risky. But MSF, of course, takes their, you know, security very seriously because they know that the proximity of us to fighting because of the nature of conflict having changed over the years is greater. And for a volunteer organization, you need to have a primary responsibility to the people who are working for you. So I never really felt particularly in threat or in danger. In fact, you know, of course, the people who were most at risk were the Sudanese people who I was treating, and the greatest risk was with, you know, malaria or tuberculosis or meningitis. So once you arrive to a place like that where you see so many soldiers and every third person has an AK-47, after a couple weeks you don't even see it anymore. You notice other things and you get habituated, and maybe that's not the best, because maybe your radar becomes a little bit duller. But after a short time, I didn't really notice. I didn't really think about it as much.
Mm. Did you think of home much?
Yeah, I think so. I think more about, you know, where is my home? What is my home? This isn't it. And, you know, was it in Toronto? Where was it? Did I have one? And so I think that many people who do this kind of work, who make it their life, kind of feel a little bit rootless, or make their world their home. I'm not sure which it is. But that concept of home is one that kind of repeats itself throughout the book, because, you know, we left our homes to go to these people's homes, who they were trying to return to it and make a life for themselves. And it's a constant, you know, that and time is a constant theme. You know, I think that I realized when I looked around at Abyei and saw the cracked brown ground, it became, you know, essentially mud in about 15 minutes of rain. And I'd wonder, who would ever live here? Why wouldn't you go anywhere but here? But I think that, you know, your home calls you in your heart, and you want to be close to that place where you fell in love for the first time, or raised your children, or you know, got to know your grandparents or your friends. So I think it's something that I thought about a lot, whether it was particular in Toronto or just in general.
Mm. Well, if I'm recalling correctly, there are a number of times, or there's at least one time, you correct me if I'm mistaken, where you've gone away for a little R&R and you come back and someone says, "Welcome home."
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was a nice feeling. It was good. Yeah, it was glad. I guess maybe home is where the people who care about you are.
Yeah.
So it was a good reminder.
Where you hang your hat at the moment.
That's right, yeah.
Well, tell us something about the members of the team you worked with in Abyei.
Well, you know, there was the vast majority of people who I worked with in Abyei were Sudanese. You know, MSF, that's one of our points of pride, or at least mine anyway, is that most people who work for MSF are national staff. So, you know, the support staff, many of the nurses were Sudanese, so our translators, obviously. Of the people who were expatriates, there was five of us. There was myself. There was a Swiss administrator at first, a British field coordinator whose job it is to assess security on the ground and have a relationship with military commanders, and a Swiss nurse, a French logistician. And the team changes. And with time, I arrived, my first day was, you know, halfway through many people's missions, so it changes, and with it, the personalities change. So especially with a small team like that, when it's just you in your compound, because once your translator goes home during the day, once they have, you know, they go home to be with their family, you're walking around in a bubble. I don't speak Dinka or Arabic, and so you're left with this, you know, this given family that you have, the five of you, in a compound. You don't leave at night because it's, you know, dangerous. And so you with some of them you make very good friends, with others you make only good colleagues. But there's this great kind of membership of being a part of that thing that is MSF, declaring yourself as interested in peace and in parity, that you kind of, it's a privilege to call these people, to live so close beside them.
Yeah. Tell us about Mohammed.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine. I miss him. He's, as far as I know, he's in Chad. He was a newly graduated Sudanese doctor, and a good one. And I say that not, you know, out of any personal affection, but I always recognize it and I respect it. He had a sharp mind and was a very good person, and in some ways was such a salvation for me when it wasn't easy for me to feel alone, to have someone who I could ask to help me out. He was, I think, well-respected and well-liked by all of the staff and stayed there for months after I left. There was a time where it became, human resources became a bit of a problem. There wasn't many people who were sticking around. People were quitting. People in Khartoum were leaving. We were getting, I was feeling very, very narrow, the conduit between you know, Khartoum and us. But he stuck around, and he stayed there after I left. And as far as I know, he's still working with MSF. I sent him a copy of my book, and I haven't heard from him in a while. It reminds me I should email, and I'd love to talk with him and know what he thinks.
Yeah. I like him very much.
Me too.
He comes across in the pages of this book as a fine man.
Yes.
Thinking about home and family and the relationships we build with one another, maybe you would read an excerpt from another entry in your in your blog, and that is a piece called Glass.
Sure. I was, this is, you know, framed in, I think there's times during the mission where you don't, you lose perspective. You're so close to things, you don't really know why you're there. Maybe it's constantly repeated to you, or was to me, maybe it was because things were thin and there was little reminders. There wasn't anyone telling you that you were doing a good job, and you realize, of course, that's not what it's about. It's not about a pat on the back, but sometimes you forget. So we talk a little bit about it between me and at least one of my friends in the mission, Tim. So Tim and I were talking just now, wondering what we were doing here, not simply as two men the same age, with friends left behind and a future on hold, but as humanitarians, as MSF. There's no active conflict, and though perhaps we were too immersed to notice small signs, things seemed peaceful. The returning population is not huddled together under plastic sheets, sharing latrines with 19 others. The hospital needs attention, so much of it. But isn't that true of nearly everywhere? The memory of the precise chemistry behind supersaturated solutions, it's fragmented, like much of my pre-medicine studies. I believe the founding principle is one of entropy, that as one adds energy to a system, it increases its randomness. What it allows is for one to add much more of a certain salt, like sodium acetate, to a heated quantity of water than it would bear otherwise. It requires a completely new and clean beaker full of pure distilled water. As one adds heat and chaos, he adds salt. It dissolves and he adds more, and more heat, and then more salt. The salt dissolves into its constituents, and the heat makes sure that the molecules ricochet faster and faster, knocking other ones loose. Soon, all the salt has been added, and it is all in parts that are flinging themselves against the glass borders of the beaker. If one removes the heat and allows the beaker to cool, the disorder lessens. The ions slow down. They spend less energy bouncing off one another, and in fact, would form crystals again if they could, but they can't. There's no solid substrate. You are left with a beaker of clear water sitting on your lab bench, full of molecules waiting to precipitate, but none of them having anything to hang on to. Now take a glass rod and just touch the inside lip of the beaker. A small piece of glass dust flakes off, so small you can't see it, and falls into the water. In an instant, the water becomes a crystal, completely solid. The molecules are at rest. I think for me, that is the reason why we're here, to be that piece of glass. It doesn't matter if you're from the north or the south or a Christian or a Muslim or a civilian or Dinka or Miseria or soldier. We deliberately don't care. Our intention is to make a place that is safe and solid for everyone in Abyei. And it is not just about medicine. That is only our tool. The hospital is not just a place to treat the Dinka infant with meningitis or the little Miseria girl with malaria, but a place where their fathers can reach for the water barrel at the same time and say to the other, after you. No, after you. And maybe, 2 weeks later, when they pass in the market, they will nod. And perhaps, 2 years from now, they might stop and talk.
That is Dr. James Miskalic reading from 6 months in Sudan, a young doctor in a war-torn village. Earlier in the book, you write about a woman who comes to the hospital. She brings nurses tea. She comes to the hospital on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And one day, she comes to the hospital sometime after being raped. Mm-hmm. She has also undergone, it is clear, what is termed infibulation. That's kind of the, I guess, neutral word for what that is. Would you tell us about that story And in this kind of a situation, as someone from the West, from North America, how do you try and stay there in that moment with that patient?
It was the first time I can remember being really angry and not understanding. I mean, infibulation is removal of the labia and the clitoris and sewing them together, so you're left with a very small introitus or entry to the vagina. And it's traditional practice in some cultures in East Africa, elsewhere, I don't know, perhaps. I remember it's the first time I, you know, relativism, saying that I just can't understand because I'm not from a culture. I mean, it's something that's been infiltrative and in some ways useful in the past many years, saying that there's something just unavailable to me because I don't understand. But I couldn't get past that intent, that she was, intent was for her to suffer. Deliberately, it seemed to me. And I had no, I mean, my heart obviously went out to her to do everything that I could. I would do everything that I could for her, no matter what it was. And so, but that was that point where I really couldn't make sense of it as a, you know, no matter how I tried to rationalize it or be conscientious. And when I wrote the book, I wanted to leave that scene in very much, because it's, not only is it powerful and true, you know, everything in that book, as far as I can recollect it, is true to what happened. But I wanted to obviously tell the story of how women, sometimes in places like this, have no opportunity to, they're not free in a way to determine their own destiny. But the worst case that I could come up with was I write about it, and then it is, you know, read by someone in Decision Maker in Khartoum, who doesn't let us import the necessary medicine or equipment to perform, you know, medical abortions. So it was something that I sent to Geneva. I was very careful, because even as much as I wanted to tell the truth, because in some ways what MSF does, as it's, you know, its raison d'etre, is to speak out sometimes on behalf of people who don't have a voice of their own. The worst thing I could imagine is that it comes out, it's read, and then 2 weeks later, there's some woman in a similar situation who can't get the medicine and the health care that she needs. So, you know, to MSF's credit, they talked about it, and it was legal in cases of medical necessity, because not only was she raped, she was also sick with an infection because of it. So I kept it in there. And also, as a reminder, I think, to perhaps other younger generations of people, if the med doctors who are interested in doing this kind of work, that it's not about you, I guess. You need to do the best you can for the person in front of you. So it was a difficult 5 pages for me to reread, but an important 5 pages for me to write.
Yeah. Was there concern about your doing a blog while you were there?
Yeah, I think that, well, Canada, I was the first blogger for MSF. And I think that the concern, the first official blogger, I think other people had done it in the past. And some people had not paid as proper attention to security. For instance, I think there was someone in Darfur who was affiliated with MSF who wrote a blog that came out against the Khartoum government, which is, you know, MSF, we, as in, because of our interest in being close to patients, we're apolitical. We're independent. Most of our donations are private. 95% of them are private. So there's very little vested interest. And so we try as much as possible to be neutral and independent. And so it required a bit of trust for MSF to let me do it. I'd written a blog before with MSF. I went through South America, through Bolivia, to write about Chagas, and Southern Africa to write about HIV, and I wrote a blog to try to tell the story of neglected diseases. And I, you know, wanted to convince them that I would be careful. And so I think that after you know, I got back. It was fairly new. There's a lot of controversy about blogs in general, from much of which I was shielded by MSF Canada. But now there's many blogs. Now there's many, many people telling the stories of what the medicine is like in Congo or in Haiti. And I think in some ways, there's tremendous access that we have to give people insight into part of the world that they wouldn't otherwise have. This publishing platform that is, you know, 2.0 allows these kind of stories to be told, maybe for the first time. And eventually, you know, my hope is that we'll have Zimbabwean people telling their own stories and things like that. And I look forward to reading them once I get a chance.
Yeah. You've written, and I quoted you in my introduction, you say that which separates action from inaction is not indifference, it is distance. And you hope that by telling stories, these stories, that distance will fall away. How do we, in this part of the world, help make that happen?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm trying to understand the nature of the world that we live in as much as possible. You know, with never been so, maybe it's always been this way, but it's never been, I've never been so easily distracted by what's available with the computer and convenience now than I have before. And so I think that maybe we don't get a chance as often to ask ourselves, you know, big questions about how we can, through our actions or our inactions, make the world that we live in. I think that if, you know, people get a chance to read my book and have an affection for Abyei or an interest in Sudan, there are places to begin. I think my website is one place to start. As things start to draw closer to the 2011 referendum, I think that's a really great time to encourage our MPs, members of Parliament in Canada, and the similar representatives in, you know, the United States, to advocate for a peaceful transition, for a fair and open election. And I think that's a chance for peace to really foment in a place that hasn't seen it for many, many years. If you know, I guess the question that I ask myself is that, is our nature like our shadow? Do we just, you know, live and love and war? Is that just what it is to be human? Or can we, through intent and through, you know, giving the best of what we know and the resources that we have, prevent some unnecessary suffering from happening? I think the latter is possible. I think that for the first time we're starting to understand the world that we live in. I know it seems like bad news on every corner and on the front page of every newspaper, but my read on it is the world isn't any worse than it was 10 or 15 years ago. We just know about it more. However, we've always, as soon as we, you know, started up that first combustion engine, the CO2 started to rise, and, you know, as soon as the cigarette butts never dissolved, and we that was always the case. And thank God we know now, and we can start to actually work towards a solution.
Mm. There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Dr. Maskelyne, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Dr. James Maskelyne, he is the author of 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. The book is published by Spiegel & Grau. You'll find more about our guest, his blog, and his book online at www.6monthsinsudan.com. I'd recommend you take a look at it and pick up the book as well, 6 Months in Sudan. A portion of the proceeds from sales of the book will go to benefit Doctors Without Borders. And that interview was conducted on August 5th of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 1:51 Central Time. Settlement prices are in from Chicago and Kansas City. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good Monday afternoon, everyone. Well, it was a stellar day for soybeans, with double-digit gains all the way out to the November of 2010 contract, with the nearbys showing the greatest strength. We'll have to talk to Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities of Normal, Illinois, about why soybeans showed such stout improvement over the opening bell, that on the closing market report coming up at 2:06 Central Time. Let's look at particulars, and we will begin in Kansas City. March wheat a high on the day of 5.39 1/4, a low of 5.23, the settlement 5.34, up 6.5. CME Group December wheat a high of 5.29 1/4, a low of 5.17, settling 5.25, up 5.75. March a high of 5.48, a low of 5.31 1/2, settling 5.43 1/2, up 6. May a high of 5.61 1/4, a low of 5.46, settling 5.56 3/4, up 6. July wheat a high of 5.71, a low of 5.54 1/4, make that a half. The settlement 5.66 3/4, up 6.5. December wheat a high of 6.09 1/2, a low of 5.92, settlement 6.04 3/4, up 6.5. December corn a high of 3.95 1/4, a low of 3.85, settlement 3.92, up 2 3/4. March a high of 4.10, a low of 3.99 1/2, the settlement 4.08 1/2, up 4. May a high of 4.20 3/4, a low of 4.10 1/2, the settlement 4.19 1/4, up 3 3/4. July corn a high of 4.30, a low of 4.20 1/4, settling 4.28 1/2, up 3.5. September a high of 4.35, a low of 4.27, settlement 4.34, up 2 3/4. December corn a high of 4.42, a low of 4.33, settlement 4.40 1/2, up 2 1/4. Take it out to July of 2011, a high of 4.63, a low of 4.59, settlement 4.62, up 2 1/4. March oats, a high of 2.61 3/4, a low of 2.57 1/2, settlement 2.58 3/4, down 1/4. January beans, a high of 10.59, a low of 10.23 1/2, settlement 10.55, up 20. March, a high of 10.66, a low of 10.32, the settlement 10.61 3/4, up 18 3/4. May, a high of 10.70, a low of 10.38 3/4, settlement at 10.66 1/4, up 17 1/4. July soybeans, a high of 10.73 3/4, a low of 10.42 3/4, settlement 10.69 1/2, up 16. August, a high of 10.66 1/4, a low of 10.50 1/2, the settlement 10.64, up 15 1/2. September, a high of 10.46 1/4, a low of 10.30 1/2, settling at 10.44, up 13. November beans, a high of 10.32 3/4, a low of 10.07 1/4, settling at 10.28 1/4, up 10 1/4. January of 2011, a high of 10.40, a low of 10.23, the settlement 10.36 1/4, up 9 3/4. March of 2011, a high of 10.40, a low of 10.28 3/4, the settlement 10.42 1/4, up 8 3/4. December soybean meal, a high of 3.35, a low of 3.14.50, the settlement 3.26.50, up $12. January, a high of 3.17, a low of 3.03, settlement 3.16.20, up 9.70. December soybean oil, a high of 39.45, a low of 39.01, settlement 39.40, up 18. January, a high of 39.84, a low of 39.20, the settlement 39.63, up 6 on the day. We'll have settlement prices in just a moment from the livestock side of CME Group. This is Dave Dickey.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
Now let's take a look at the livestock contracts and how they finished today in Chicago. Higher day today, generally across the board for livestock. December live cattle 81.10, the high 80.30, the low 81.05, the settlement up 90. February 84.05, the high 83.35, the low 83.95, the settlement up 67.5. April 87.45, the high 86.70, the low 87.32.5, the settlement. That contract finished up 90 on the day today. June 84.80, the high 84.37.5, the low, the settlement 84.70, up 42.5. January feeder cattle 92 even, the high 91.70, the low 91.90, the settlement up 32.5. March 92.75, the high 92.35, the low 92.37.5, the settlement unchanged. April 94.40, the high 94 even, the low 94.07.5, the settlement that down 10. May 95.35, the high 95.12.5, the low, the settlement 95.20, unchanged. December lean hog 64.60, the high 64.10, the low 64.57.5, the settlement up 57.5. February 66.50, the high 65.45, the low, the settlement 65.87.5, up 45. April 70.57.5, the high 69.80, the low, the settlement 70.32.5, up 72.5. May lean hog 75.20, the high, the low 74.30, the settlement 75.15, up 27.5. And February bellies were up $3 today, 89.10, the high 86.30, the low 89.10, the settlement again that up $3. The Dow is currently up 25 points at 10,496, the NASDAQ up 18 at 2209, and the S&P 500 6 higher at 1113. Nearby crude down 39 at 69.46. It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. The forecast for Illinois and Indiana is prepared by Mike Sulla this afternoon in northwestern Illinois. Cloudy with some fog and scattered flurries or a few snow showers. Elsewhere in the north, cloudy with scattered areas of drizzle and patchy fog. In central and southern sections, mostly cloudy with scattered sprinkles. Highs this afternoon ranging from 32 in far northwestern Illinois to around 60 in southeastern Indiana. Tonight, cloudy skies with patchy drizzle in Indiana and southern Illinois during the evening hours. Lows ranging from 5 in far northwestern Illinois to 27 in far southeastern Indiana. Tomorrow in western Illinois, mostly sunny, elsewhere cloudy early, then becoming mostly sunny from west to east. Highs tomorrow ranging from 8 in far northwestern Illinois to 38 in far southeastern Indiana. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly cloudy and breezy with a chance of patchy drizzle, the high near 50. The wind shifting to westerly, then northwesterly at 12 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy and colder, the low 22. The wind from the northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy early, then becoming mostly sunny. The high only around 30. The wind from the northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. The outlook for tomorrow night, clear, the low 14. Wednesday, sunny. The high, 35. At 2 o'clock, 48 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. More on the weather coming up as part of the closing market report this afternoon with Dave Dickey. That follows news from NPR in Washington. Stay tuned.